Why did you not make a dash for it? I told you at the time that...
He yawned, but only with his jaw, without opening his mouth. Does he or does he not know that I proposed? Thought Lievin, looking at him. Yes. There is something sly and diplomatic in his face. And feeling himself blush, he gazed in silence straight into Oblonsky's eyes.
If there was anything on her side at that time, it was only the external attraction, continued Oblonsky. You know, his being a perfect aristocrat and his future position in society had an effect not on her, but on her mother.
Lievin frowned. The insult of the refusal he had had to face burned in his heart like a fresh, newly received wound. But he was at home, and the walls of home are helpful.
"Wait, wait," he began, interrupting Oblonsky. "You talk of his being an aristocrat, but I should like to ask you what his Vronsky's or anyone else's aristocracy that I should be slighted because of it. You consider Vronsky an aristocrat? I don't. A man whose father crawled up from nothing by intrigues and whose mother has had relations with heaven knows whom.
No, pardon me, I consider myself and people like me aristocrats. People who can point back to three or four honourable generations of their family, all with a high standard of education, talent and intelligence are a different matter, who have never cringed before anyone, never depended on anyone, but have lived as my father and my grandfather did. I know many such. You consider it mean for me to count the trees in my wood while you give Ryabinin 30,000 rubles, but you will receive a government grant, and I don't know what other rewards, and I shan't, so I value what is mine by birth and labour. We, and not those who only manage to exist by the bounty of the mighty of this world and who can be bought for a piece of silver, are the aristocrats.
But whom are you driving at? I agree with you, said Oblonsky, sincerely and cheerfully, though he felt that Lievin ranked him with those who could be bought for silver.
Lievin's vehemence sincerely pleased him.
Whom are you driving at? Though much of what you say is not true of Vronsky, I'm not speaking about that. I want to tell you candidly that if I were you, I'd come to Moscow now with me and...
No. I don't know if you knew it or not, and I don't care, but I will tell you. I proposed and was refused, and your sister-in-law, Katerina Alexandrovna, is now only a painful and humiliating memory to me.
Why? What nonsense!
But don't let us talk about it. Forgive me, please, if I have been rude to you, said Lievin. Now that he had spoken out, he became once more as he had been in the morning.
You're not angry with me, Stiva? Please, don't be angry, he said, smiling, and took his hand.
Oh, no, not at all. There was nothing to be angry about. I'm glad we've had this explanation. And you know, the shooting in the early morning is often very good. Shall we not go?
I would not sleep again after it, but go straight from there to the station.
A capital idea.
Chapter 18. Though Vronsky's whole inner life was absorbed by his passion, his external life ran unalterably and inevitably along its former customary rails of social and regimental connections and interests. The interest of the regiment occupied an important place in his life because he was fond of his regiment, and still more because the regiment was fond of him. Not only were they fond of him, they respected him too and were proud of him. Proud that this man, with his enormous wealth and excellent education and abilities, to whom the road to success of all kinds gratifying to ambition or vanity lay open, had disregarded all this, and of all life's interests had nearest to his heart those of his regiment and his comrades. Vronsky was aware of this attitude of his comrades toward him, and, besides liking the life, felt bound to justify their view of him. It goes without saying that he spoke to none of them about his love, nor did he betray himself even in the wildest drinking bouts,
Indeed, he never drank so as to lose all self-control, and he silenced any of his thoughtless comrades who tried to hint at the liaison. But in spite of this, his love affair was known to all the town. Everybody guessed, more or less correctly, what his relations with Anna Karenina were. Most of the young men envied him just on account of what was most trying in the affair, namely Karenin's high rank and the consequent prominence of the affair in society. The majority of young women who envied Anna and had long been weary of hearing her virtues praised were pleased at what they guessed, and only waited to be sure that public opinion had turned before throwing the whole weight of their scorn at her. They already prepared lumps of mud to pelt her with in due time. Most of the older people, and of those highly placed, regretted this impending social scandal. Vronsky's mother, on hearing of the matter, was at first pleased, both because, in her opinion, nothing gave such finishing touches to a brilliant young man as an intrigue in the best society, and also because this Anna Karenina, who had so taken her fancy, and who had talked so much about her little son, was, after all, such as the Countess Vronsky expected all handsome and well-bred women to be. But latterly she had heard that her son had refused a post of importance for his career, merely to remain with his regiment and be able to see Anna Karenina, and that exalted persons were dissatisfied with him for it, so she changed her opinion. She was also displeased because, from all she heard of it, this affair was not one of those brilliant, graceful society liaisons which she approved, but a desperate, Werther-like passion which might lead him into doing something foolish. She had not seen him since his sudden departure from Moscow, and through her eldest son she sent him word to come and see her. The elder brother was also dissatisfied with the younger. He did not distinguish what kind of love it was, great or small, passionate or passionless, guilty or pure. He himself, the father of a family, kept a ballet girl and was therefore lenient in these matters. But he knew that it was a love affair which displeased those whom it is necessary to please, and he therefore disapproved of his brother's conduct. Besides his military and social interests, Vronsky had another one, namely horses, of which he was passionately fond. That year there was to be an officer's steeplechase, and Vronsky had put down his name, bought an English thoroughbred mare, and in spite of his love was passionately, though restrainedly, concerned about the coming races. The two passions did not interfere with one another. On the contrary, he needed an occupation and an interest apart from his love, in which to refresh himself and find rest from the impressions which agitated him too violently. Chapter 19. On the day of the Krasnoye Selo races, Vronsky came earlier than usual to the regimental messroom to eat his beefsteak. It was not necessary for him to train very strictly, as his weight was just the regulation 11.5 stone. But he had to be careful not to get fatter, and therefore avoided sweets and starchy foods. He sat waiting with his elbows on the table and his coat unbuttoned over a white waistcoat, and while waiting for the beefsteak he had ordered, he looked at the pages of a French novel that lay on his plate. He only looked at the book in order not to have to talk to the officers who came in and out of the room while he was thinking. He thought of Anna, who had promised to meet him after the races. But he had not seen her for 3 days, and, as her husband had returned from abroad, he did not know whether she would keep the appointment today or not, and he did not know how to find out. He had seen her last at his cousin Betsy's country house. He went to the Karenins' country house as seldom as possible, but now he meant to go there and was considering how to do it. "Of course, I can say that Betsy sent me to find out if she will be at the race." "Yes, of course I will go," he decided, lifting his eyes from the book, and a vivid sense of the joy of seeing her made his face radiant. "Send to my house and tell them to harness 3 horses to the caleche at once," he said to the waiter who had brought him a beefsteak on a hot silver plate, and drawing the plate nearer to him, he began to eat. From the neighbouring billiard room came the click of balls, talk, and laughter. 2 officers appeared at the entrance door, one with a weak, thin face, a young officer who had just joined the regiment from the cadet corps, the other a plump, old officer with a bracelet on his arm and small eyes sunk in a bloated face. Vronsky glanced at them, frowned, and as if he had not noticed them, turned his eyes on his book and began to eat and read at the same time.
"What? Fortifying yourself for your job?" asked the plump officer,
taking a seat beside him.
"As you see,"
said Vronsky, frowning and wiping his mouth without looking at the speaker.
"Not afraid of getting fat?"
said the other, turning a chair round for the young officer.
"What?"
said Vronsky, frowning, making a grimace of disgust and showing his regular teeth.
"Not afraid of getting fat?" "Waiter, sherry,"
said Vronsky, without replying, and moving his book to the other side of his plate, he continued to read. The plump officer took the wine list and turned to the young one.
"You choose what we shall drink,"
said he, handing him the list and looking at him.
"Suppose we have some Rhine wine,"
said the young one, turning his eyes timidly to Vronsky while his fingers tried to catch hold of his just-budding moustache. Seeing that Vronsky did not turn round, he rose.
"Let us go into the billiard room," he said.
The plump officer got up obediently, and they made their way toward the door. At that moment, Captain Yashvin, a tall man with a fine figure, entered the room, and having given a contemptuous backward nod to the two officers, he came up to Vronsky.
"Ah, here he is," he exclaimed,
and with his big hand gave Vronsky a sharp slap on his shoulder strap. Vronsky looked up angrily, but his face brightened at once into its characteristic look of quiet, firm kindliness.
"That is wise, Alexei," said the captain in a loud baritone. "Eat now and drink one small glass."
"I don't want to eat."
"There are the inseparables," added Yashvin,
glancing ironically at the two officers who were just going out of the room. He sat down beside Vronsky, and his legs, encased in tight riding breeches, being too long for the size of the chair, bent at a sharp angle at the hip and knee joints.
"Why did you not come to the Krasninsky Theatre last night?"
"I stayed late at the Tverskoy's."
"Ah,"
said Yashvin. Yashvin, a gambler, a rake, a man not merely without principles, but with bad principles, was Vronsky's best friend in the regiment. Vronsky liked him both for his extraordinary physical strength, which he chiefly demonstrated by his ability to drink like a fish and go without sleep without making any difference to him, and for the great mental power which was apparent in his relations with his commanding officers and comrades who feared and respected him, and in his card playing when he staked tens of thousands of rubles and, in spite of what he drank, always with such skill and decision that he was considered the best player in the English club. Vronsky respected and liked Yashvin, particularly because he felt that the latter liked him, not for his name and money, but for himself. Among all the people Vronsky knew, Yashvin was the only one to whom he would have liked to talk about his love. He felt that Yashvin, though apparently despising all emotion, was the only one who could understand the power of the passion that now filled his whole life. Besides, he felt sure that Yashvin certainly found no pleasure in gossip and scandal and understood his feeling in the right way. That is, knew and believed that this love was not a joke or an amusement, but something more serious and important. Vronsky did not talk to him of his love, but was aware that he knew all about it and understood it rightly, and it was pleasant to him to read this in Yashvin's eyes.
"Ah, yes," he said when he heard that Vronsky had been at the Tverskoy's.
His black eyes sparkled, and he began twisting his left moustache round into his mouth, a bad habit he had.
"Well, and what were you doing last night?"
"Winning?" asked Vronsky.
8,000. But three of them doubtful. I do not expect he will pay up."
"Well, then, you can afford to lose on me," said Vronsky, laughing.
Yashvin had staked heavily on Vronsky.
"I am sure not to lose. Makhotin is the only dangerous one."
The conversation turned to the forecast of the day's race, the only subject Vronsky could now think about.
"Let us go. I have finished," said Vronsky, and he rose and moved toward the door.
Yashvin rose also and stretched his great legs and long back.
"It is too early for me to dine, but I must have a drink. I will come in a minute. Hello, wine!"
he cried in his loud voice, which was so famous a drill, and here made the glasses tremble.
"No, I do not want any," he shouted again. "You are going home, and I'll go with you."
And he and Vronsky went out together. Chapter 20 Vronsky had his quarters in a roomy, clean, Finnish peasant cottage, divided in two by a partition. Here in camp also, Petritsky was asleep when Vronsky and Yashvin entered.
"Get up, you've slept enough," said Yashvin, stepping behind the partition and shaking by the shoulder the dishevelled Petritsky, who lay with his nose buried in the pillow. Petritsky suddenly sprang to his knees and looked round.
"Your brother has been here,"
he said to Vronsky.
"He woke me up, devil take him. He said he would come back."
And drawing up his blanket, he threw himself back on his pillow.
"Leave me alone, Yashvin," he said angrily to Yashvin, who was pulling the blanket off him. "Leave off!"
He turned and opened his eyes.
"You better tell me what to drink. I've such a horrid taste in my mouth that..."
"Vodka is better than anything," said Yashvin in his bass voice.
"Tereshenko, vodka and pickled cucumbers for your master,"
he shouted, evidently enjoying the sound of his own voice.
"Vodka, you think, eh?"
asked Petritsky, making a face and rubbing his eyes.
"And will you have a drink? Oh, let us have a drink together. Vronsky, will you have a drink?"
said Petritsky, getting up and wrapping himself to the arms in a rug of tiger-skin pattern. He went to the partition door, held up his hands, and began singing in French. There was a king in Toul.
"Vronsky, will you have a drink?"
"Get away," said Vronsky, as he put on the overcoat his servant had handed him.
"Where to now?" asked Yashvin. "Here are the horses," he added, as he saw the calèche drive up to the door.
"To the stables, and then I have to go to Bryansky about the horses," said Vronsky.
He had really promised to go to Bryansky's, who lived 7 miles from Peterhof, and pay him for the horses, and he hoped to make time to call there too. But his friends understood at once that it was not only there that he was going. Petritsky, still singing, winked his eyes and pouted as if to say, "We know what sort of Bryansky it is."
"Mind and don't be late," was all Yashvin said. And to change the subject, he asked, "Is my roan doing well?" looking out of the window at the middle horse which he had sold to Vronsky.
"Wait!" shouted Petritsky to Vronsky, who was already going out. "Your brother left a letter for you, and a note."
"Oh, wait, where are they?"
Vronsky stopped.
"Well, where are they?"
"Where are they? That is the question," declaimed Petritsky with solemnity, moving his finger upwards from his nose.
"Come, tell me! This is stupid," said Vronsky, smiling.
"I have not lighted the fire. They must be somewhere here."
"Enough of this. Where is the letter?"
"No, really, I have forgotten. Or was it a dream?" "Wait, wait, why get angry?
If you had emptied 4 bottles ahead as we did last night, you would not know where you were lying."
"Oh, wait a bit, I'll remember it directly."
Petritsky went behind the partition and lay down on his bed.
"Wait. So I lay, and so he stood. Ah, yes, 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 here it is."
And Petritsky drew the letter from under the mattress where he had put it. Vronsky took the letter and his brother's note. It was just what he had expected. A letter from his mother reproaching him for not having come to see her, and a note from his brother saying that they must talk things over. Vronsky knew that it all referred to the same subject. "What business is it of theirs?" thought he, and crumpling up the letters he pushed them in between the buttons of his coat, to be read more attentively on the way. In the passage he met two officers, one of his own and one of another regiment. Vronsky's quarters were always the haunt of all the officers.
"Where are you going?"
"I have to go to Peterhof."
"Has the mayor come from Tsarskoe?"
"Yes, but I have not seen her since she came.
They say Machotin's gladiator has gone lame."
"Oh, nonsense.
But how will you manage to ride through such mud?" said the other officer.
"These are the things to restore me,"
shouted Petritsky on seeing the newcomers. The orderly stood before him with vodka and pickled cucumbers on a tray.
"Yashvin here has ordered vodka to freshen me up."
"Well, you did give it us last night," said one of the newcomers. "You did not let us sleep all night."
"Oh, but how we finished up," said Petritsky.
"Volkov climbed out onto the roof and said he felt melancholy. I said, 'Let us have music, a funeral march.' And he fell asleep up there on the roof to the sound of the funeral march."
"Drink. You must drink some vodka and then some seltzer water with plenty of lemon," said Yashvin, standing over Petritsky like a mother urging her child to take its medicine. "And after that, a little champagne, a small bottle."
"Now, that is reasonable. Wait, Vronsky, let us have a drink."
"No, goodbye, gentlemen. I am not drinking today."
"Why, because of the weight?
Well, then we will drink by ourselves.
Let's have seltzers and lemons."
"Vronsky," shouted someone as Vronsky was already leaving.
"What?"
"You should have your hair cut. It'll be too heavy, especially on the top." Vronsky was really beginning prematurely to get a little bald. He laughed merrily, showing his compact row of teeth, and drawing his cap over the bald patch, went out and got into the calèche.
"To the stables," he said,
and was taking out the letter to read, but then changed his mind, not wishing to be upset before examining his horse. "Later will do."
Chapter 21 The temporary stable, a wooden structure, had been built close to the racecourse, and it was there his mare was to have been brought the day before. He had not yet been to look at her. During these last days he had not exercised her himself, but had entrusted it to the trainer, and therefore did not in the least know in what condition she had arrived, or now was. Hardly had he stepped out of the calèche before his groom, who had recognised it from a distance, had called out the trainer. A lean Englishman in top boots and a short jacket, with only a tuft of beard left under his chin, came to meet him with the awkward gait of a jockey swaying from side to side with his elbows sticking out.
"Well, how is Frou Frou?"
asked Vronsky in English.
"All right, sir,"
came the answer from somewhere inside the man's throat.
"You better not go in," he added, touching his cap. "I've put a muzzle on her and she's fidgety. You better not go in, it excites the mare."
"No, I'll go in, I want to have a look at her."
"Come along,"
said the Englishman, frowning and speaking as before without opening his mouth. Swaying his elbows and walking with his loose gait, he led the way. They entered a little yard in front of the shed. A smart, well-dressed lad in a short and clean jacket with a broom in his hand met them and followed them. In the shed, five horses stood in the horse boxes, and Vronsky knew that his principal rival, Machotin's 16-hand chestnut gladiator, was to have been brought that day and should be standing there too. Vronsky was even more anxious to have a look at Gladiator, whom he had never seen, than at his own mare. But he knew that horse-racing etiquette not only forbade his seeing it, but made it improper for him even to ask about it. As he went along the passage, the lad opened the second horse box to the left, and Vronsky caught sight of a big chestnut horse with white legs. He knew it was Gladiator, but like one who avoids seeing another's open letter, he turned and went to Frou Frou's box.
"Here's the horse of I can never pronounce his name," said the Englishman over his shoulder, pointing with his black-nailed thumb to Gladiator's box.
"Machotin's?"
"Yes, that is my only serious rival," said Vronsky. "If you were riding him, I would back you," said the Englishman.
"Oh, Frou Frou is the braver, but the other is the more powerful horse," said Vronsky, smiling at the compliment to his riding.
In a steeplechase, everything depends on the riding and on pluck, said the Englishman.
Vronsky felt that he not only had enough pluck, that is, energy and courage, but, what is much more important, he was firmly convinced that no one in the world could have more pluck than he had.
Are you quite sure that more training was unnecessary?
Quite unnecessary, said the Englishman. Please, don't talk loud. The mare is nervous, he added, nodding toward the closed horse box before which they were standing, and from which was heard the trampling of hoofs among the straw. He opened the door, and Vronsky entered the box, which was dimly lit by one small window. In the box stood a muzzled, dark bay mare, stepping from foot to foot among the fresh litter. When he had got used to the dim light of the box, Vronsky again instinctively took in at one comprehensive glance all the points of his favourite mare. Frou Frou was of medium size and by no means free from blemish. She was slenderly built. Her chest, though well arched, was narrow. Her hindquarters tapered rather too much, and her legs, especially her hind legs, were perceptibly bowed inwards. Neither fore nor hind legs were particularly muscular, but on the other hand she was extremely broad in the girth now that she was lean from her strict training. Seen from the front, her cannon bones were very fine and sharp, but unusually wide seen sideways. She appeared all the more narrow in build because so deep in the breadth, but she possessed in the highest degree a characteristic which made one forget all her defects. This was her thoroughbred quality, the kind of blood that tells, as they say in English. The muscles, clearly marked beneath the network of sinews, stretched in the fine, mobile skin which was smooth as satin, seemed hard as bone. Her lean head, with the prominent, bright, sparkling eyes, broadened out to her muzzle with its wide crimson nostrils. Her whole appearance, more especially about the head, was spirited yet gentle. She was one of those creatures who seem as if they would certainly speak if only the mechanical construction of their mouths allowed them to. To Vronsky, at any rate, it seemed that she understood all he was feeling while looking at her. As soon as Vronsky entered, she drew a deep breath, and turning her prominent eyes so that their whites became bloodshot, looked from the other side of the box at the newcomers, shook her muzzle, and stepped lightly from foot to foot.
"Eh, see how nervous she is," said the Englishman.
"Oh, you darling," said Vronsky, stepping toward the horse and soothing her. But the nearer he came, the more nervous she grew. Only when he reached to her head did she suddenly calm down, and the muscles under her fine, delicate coat vibrated. Vronsky stroked her firm neck, adjusted a lock of her mane that had got onto the wrong side of her sharply defined withers, and brought his face close to her dilated nostrils, delicate as a bat's wing. Her extended nostrils loudly inhaled and exhaled her breath, and she set back one of her finely pointed ears with a start, and stretched out her black, firm lips toward Vronsky, as if wishing to catch hold of his sleeve. But remembering her muzzle, she gave it a jerk, and again began stepping from one of her finely chiseled feet to the other.
"Be quiet, darling, be quiet," he said, again stroking her flank, and left the box with a joyful conviction that the horse was in the very best condition.
The mare's excitement had communicated itself to Vronsky. He felt that the blood was rushing to his heart, and that he, like the horse, wished to move and to bite. It was both frightening and joyful.
"Well, then, I rely on you," said Vronsky to the Englishman. "You will be on the spot at 6:30.
"All right," said the Englishman.
"And where are you going, my lord?"
he asked unexpectedly, addressing him as "my lord," which he hardly ever did. Vronsky raised his head in amazement, and looked as he knew how to, not into the Englishman's eyes, but at his forehead, surprised at the boldness of the question. But realizing that the Englishman in asking the question regarded him not as an employer, but as a jockey, he replied,
"I have to see Briansky, but I shall be home in an hour."
How often have I been asked that question today, he thought, and blushed, a thing he rarely did. The Englishman looked at him attentively, and as if he knew where he was going, added, "The chief thing before a race is to keep cool. Don't be put out or upset." "All right," said Vronsky, smiling, and jumping into the calèche, he told the coachman to drive to Peterhof. He had not gone many yards before the clouds, which had been threatening since morning, broke, and there was a downpour of rain. "This is bad," thought Vronsky, raising the hood of the calèche. "It was muddy before, but now it'll be a swamp." Sitting alone in the closed calèche, he drew out his mother's letter and his brother's note and read them through. Yes, it was the same thing over and over again. They all, his mother and his brother and everybody, considered it necessary to interfere with his intimate affairs. This interference roused him to anger, a feeling he rarely experienced. What business is it of theirs? Why does everybody consider it his duty to look after me? And why do they bother me? Because they see it as something they cannot understand. If it were an ordinary, empty society intrigue, they would let me alone. They feel that it is something different, that it is not a game, and that this woman is dearer to me than life. That is incomprehensible, and therefore it vexes them. "Whatever our fate is or may be, we have made it and do not complain of it," he said, joining Anna and himself in the word "we." "No, they needs must teach us how to live. They have no conception of what happiness is, and they do not know that without love there is no happiness or unhappiness for us, for there would be no life," he thought. He was angry with everybody for their interference, just because he felt in his soul that they were right. He felt that the love that united him with Anna was not momentary infatuation which would pass, as society intrigues do, without leaving any trace in the lives of the one or the other except pleasant or disagreeable memories. He felt all the torment of his and her position, all the difficulties they were surrounded by in consequence of their station in life, which exposed them to the eyes of the whole world, obliged them to hide their love, to lie and deceive, and again to lie and deceive, to scheme and constantly think about others while the passion that bound them was so strong that they both forgot everything but their love. The recollection of incidents often repeated rose vividly in his mind, where lies and deceptions revolting to his nature had been necessary. He remembered most vividly having more than once noticed her feeling of shame at the necessity for this deception and lying. And he experienced a strange feeling which, since his union with Anna, sometimes overcame him. It was a feeling of revulsion against something, against Karenin, or against himself, or against the whole world, he hardly knew which. But he always drove away this strange feeling. And now, too, having given himself a shake, he continued the current of his thoughts. Yes, formerly she was unhappy, but proud and calm. But now she cannot be calm and dignified, though she still seems so. Yes, this must be brought to an end, he decided. And for the first time, the clear idea occurred to him that it was necessary to put an end to all this falsehood, and the sooner the better. Throw up everything, and let us two conceal ourselves somewhere alone with our love, said he to himself. Chapter 22. The downpour did not last long, and as Vronsky approached his destination, with his shaft horse at full trot pulling alone and the trace horses galloping over the mud with the traces loose, the sun appeared again. The roofs of the houses and the old lime trees in the gardens on both sides glittered with the moisture, and the water dripped merrily from the branches and ran down from the roofs. He no longer thought about the shower spoiling the race course, but was glad because, Thanks to the rain, he was sure to find Anna at home and alone, for he knew that Karenin, who had recently returned from a watering place abroad, had not moved from Petersburg. Hoping to find her alone, Vronsky, as usual, to attract less attention, alighted before crossing the little bridge that led to the house and walked on. He did not go straight to the entrance from the street, but passed through the yard.
"Has your master returned?" he asked a gardener.
"No, sir. The mistress is at home. Go in at the front door. The servants are there, and we'll open it," replied the man.
"No, I will go through the garden."
Having made sure that she was alone, and wishing to take her by surprise, he had not promised to come that day, and she would certainly not expect him to come before the races, he went, holding up his sword and stepping carefully along the sand-strewn flower-bordered path to the veranda facing the garden. Vronsky had now forgotten all his thoughts on the way about the hardness and difficulty of his situation. He only thought that he would see her immediately, not merely in fancy, but alive, all of her, as she was in reality. He was already ascending the shallow steps of the veranda, stepping on the whole of his foot so as not to make a noise, when he suddenly remembered what he was always forgetting, the most painful part of his relations with her, namely, her son, with his questioning and, as it seemed to Vronsky, inimical look. That boy was a more frequent hindrance to their relations than anyone else. When he was present, neither Vronsky nor Anna allowed themselves to speak about anything they could not have mentioned to everyone, or even to hint at things the boy would not have understood. They had not arranged this, but it had come about of itself. They would have considered it unworthy of themselves to deceive that child. In his presence they talked as acquaintances. Yet, despite this caution, Vronsky often noticed the child's attentive and perplexed gaze fixed upon him, and a strange timidity and unevenness, now caressing, now cold and bashful, in the boy's manner toward him. It was as if the child felt that between that man and his mother there was some important relation which he could not understand. And the boy really felt that he could not understand this relation. He tried, but could not make out what he ought to feel toward this man. With a child's sensitiveness to indications of feeling, he clearly saw that his father, his governess, and his nurse all not only disliked Vronsky, but regarded him with fear and loathing, though they said nothing about him, while his mother regarded him as her best friend.
"What does it mean? Who is he? How should I love him? If I don't understand, it is my fault. I'm a silly or a bad boy," thought the child.
And that was the cause of his testing, questioning, and to some extent hostile expression, and of the shyness and fitfulness Vronsky found so irksome. The presence of that child always aroused in Vronsky that strange feeling of unreasoning revulsion which had of late come to him. It evoked, both in Vronsky and in Anna, a feeling such as a sailor might have, who saw by the compass that the direction in which he was swiftly sailing diverged widely from the right course but was quite unable to stop, and felt that every moment was taking him farther and farther astray, and that to acknowledge to himself that he was diverging from the right direction was tantamount to acknowledging that he was lost. This child, with his naive outlook on life, was the compass which showed them their degree of divergence from what they knew but would not recognize as the right course. This time Seretse was not at home, and Anna was quite alone, sitting on the veranda, waiting for the return of her son, who had gone for a walk and had been caught in the rain. She had sent a man and a maidservant to look for him, and sat waiting. She wore a white dress trimmed with wide embroidery, and as she sat in a corner of the veranda behind some plants, did not hear Vronsky coming. Bowing her curly head, she pressed her forehead against a cold watering can that stood on the balustrade, and both her beautiful hands, with the rings he knew so well, were holding the can. The beauty of her whole figure, her head, her neck, and her arms, always struck Vronsky with new surprise. He stopped, gazing at her with rapture. But just as he was going to step toward her, She felt his nearness, pushed away the can, and turned her hot face toward him. "What is the matter? Aren't you well?" he said in French as he came up to her. He wished to run toward her, but remembering that there might be others near, turned to look at the veranda door, and blushed as he always did when he felt that he had reason to fear and to be circumspect. "No, I am quite well," she said, rising, and firmly pressing his outstretched hand. "I did not expect you."
"Oh, heavens, what cold hands," he said.
"You frightened me," she said. "I am alone and was expecting Seretse. He went for a walk. They will return this way." But though she tried to be calm, her lips trembled.
"Forgive me for coming, but I could not let the day pass without seeing you," he continued in French.
In Russian, the word "you" sounded cold, and it was dangerous to say "thou," so he always spoke French to her.
"Why, forgive? I'm so glad."
"But you are ill, or in trouble," he continued, without releasing her hand, but bending over it.
"What were you thinking about?"
"Always about the same thing," she said with a smile. She spoke the truth. Whenever, at whatever moment, she was asked what she was thinking about, she could have answered without fail, "Always about my happiness and my unhappiness." Just now, when he entered, she was wondering why for others, Betsy, for instance, of whose secret relations with Tushkevich she knew, it was all easy, while for her it was so tormenting. For certain reasons, this thought troubled her more particularly today. She inquired about the races. Vronsky answered her, and noticing that she was excited, in order to distract her thoughts, began giving her, in a very matter-of-fact way, particulars of the preparations for the races. "Shall I tell him or not?" she thought, looking at his calm, caressing eyes. "He is so happy, so full of his races, that he won't understand it properly. Won't understand all the importance of the event for us."
"But you have not told me what you were thinking about when I came in," he said, breaking off his narration.
She did not answer, but slightly bowing her head, looked at him from under her brows, questioningly, her eyes shining from under their long lashes. Her hand, toying with a leaf that she had pulled off, trembled. He noticed this, and his face assumed that submissive, slavishly devoted expression that had such an effect on Anna.
"I see that something has happened. How can I be a moment at peace knowing that you have some sorrow which I am not sharing?"
"Tell me, for heaven's sake," repeated he, entreatingly. "I cannot forgive him if he does not understand all the importance of it. Better not tell him. Why put him to the proof?" she thought, continuing to look at him in the same way, and feeling that her hand with the leaf was trembling more and more.
"For heaven's sake," he repeated, taking her hand.
"Shall I?"
"Yes, yes, yes."
"I am pregnant," she said, softly and slowly. The leaf in her hand shook still more violently, but she did not move her eyes from his face, watching to see how he would take it. He grew pale, tried to say something, but stopped, dropped her hand, and bowed his head.
"Yes, he understands its full significance," she thought, and gratefully pressed his hand.
But she was mistaken in thinking that he understood the importance of the news as she, a woman, understood it. It brought on with tenfold force an attack of that strange repulsion to he knew not whom. But at the same time he felt that the crisis he had hoped for had now come, that concealment from the husband was no longer possible, and that somehow or other the unnatural situation must be quickly ended. But besides this, her physical agitation communicated itself to him. He gave her a look full of emotion, humbly kissed her hand, rose, and began silently pacing up and down the veranda.
"Yes," he said, resolutely approaching her. "Neither you nor I looked on our union as an amusement, and now our fate is sealed." "We must end," he went on, looking round, "this falsehood in which we are living."
"End it? How are we to end it, Alexei?" she said softly. She was quiet now, and her face shone with a tender smile.
"By your leaving your husband and our uniting our lives."
"They are united already," she replied in a scarcely audible tone. "Yes, but entirely." "But how, Alexei? Teach me how," she said with pathetic irony at the inevitability of her position. "Is there any escape from such a position? Am I not my husband's wife?"
"There is a way out of every position. One has to take a decision," he said. "Anything would be better than the condition in which you are living. Don't I see how you suffer from everything? Society, your son, and your husband?"
"Oh, but not through my husband," she said with natural irony. "I don't know him and don't think about him. He does not exist."
"You are not speaking sincerely. I know you. You suffer from him too."
"But he does not even know," she said, and suddenly a vivid flush suffused her face. Her cheeks, her forehead, and her neck turned red, and tears of shame appeared in her eyes. "Do not let us speak of him."
Chapter 23. Vronsky had tried several times before, though never so definitely as now, to lead her on to a discussion of her position, and had always encountered the same superficiality and lightness of judgment with which she now replied to his challenge. It was as if there was something that she could not and would not make clear to herself, or as if, as soon as she began to speak about this matter, she, the real Anna, withdrew into herself, and another woman appeared who was strange and alien to him, whom he feared and did not like, and who resisted him. But today he decided to speak out.
"Whether he knows or not," said Vronsky in his usual firm, calm tone, "that is not our business. We cannot, you cannot, remain as you are, especially now."
"What would you have me do?" she asked with the same light irony. She, who had so feared that he might take her pregnancy too lightly, now felt vexed that he deduced therefrom the necessity of doing something.
"Tell him everything. Leave him."
"Very well. Suppose I do so," she said. "Do you know what the result will be?" "I will tell it you all in advance." And an evil light came into her eyes, which a minute before had been so tender. "Ah, you love another, and have entered into a guilty union with him?" Mimicking her husband, she laid just such a stress on the word guilty as Karenin himself would have done. "I warned you of the consequences from the religious, civil, and family points of view. You have not listened to me. Now I cannot allow my name to be dishonored." "My name and my son," she was going to say, but could not jest about her son. "My name to be dishonored, and something else of that kind," she added. "In short, he will tell me clearly and precisely, in his official manner, that he cannot let me go, but will take what measures he can to prevent a scandal.
and he will do what he says, quietly and accurately. That is what will happen. He's not a man, but a machine, and a cruel machine when angry, she added, picturing Karenin to herself with every detail of his figure and way of speaking, setting against him everything bad she could find in him and forgiving him nothing on account of the terrible fault toward him of which she was guilty. "But Anna," said Vronsky, persuasively and gently, trying to pacify her, "he must be told all the same, and afterwards our action will be guided by his attitude." "What then? Run away?" "And why not run away? I think it is impossible to continue in this way. And not on my account. I see that you suffer." "Yes, run away, and for me to live as your mistress," she said maliciously. "Anna," he murmured with reproachful tenderness. "Yes," she continued, "become your mistress and ruin my everything." She was again going to say son, but could not utter the word. Vronsky could not understand how she, with her strong, honest nature, could endure this state of deception and not wish to escape from it. But he did not guess that the chief cause lay in the one word son, which she could not bring herself to utter. When she thought about her son and his future relations with the mother who had left his father, she was so terrified at what she had done that she did not reason, but womanlike only tried to comfort herself with false arguments and words in order that everything should remain as before, and that she might forget the dreadful question of what would happen to her son. "I beg you, I entreat you," said she suddenly, in quite an altered tone, sincerely and tenderly, taking him by the hand. "Never to speak to me about that."
"But Anna, never.
Leave it to me. I know all the degradation, all the horror of my position. But it is not so easy to settle the matter as you think. Leave it to me and listen to me. Never speak to me about it. Do you promise?" "Yes, yes. Promise!"
"I promise everything.
But I cannot be at peace, especially after what you have told me. I cannot be at peace when you are not." "I?" she said. "Yes, I do suffer sometimes. But it will pass if you never speak to me about it. It is only when you speak to me about it that I suffer."
"I don't understand," said he.
"I know," she interrupted him, "how hard it is for your honest nature to lie, and I pity you. I often think how you have ruined your life because of me."
"I was just thinking the same," he said, "wondering how you could sacrifice everything for my sake. I cannot forgive myself for your unhappiness."
"I unhappy?" she said, drawing near to him and gazing at him with a smile of rapturous love. "I am like a hungry man to whom food has been given. He may be cold, his clothes may be ragged, and he may be ashamed. But he's not unhappy." "I unhappy? No, this is my happiness." But she heard the voice of her son approaching, and glancing quickly round the veranda, she rose hurriedly. Her eyes kindled with the light Vronsky knew so well, and with a rapid motion she raised her lovely hands covered with rings, seized his head, gave him a long look, lifted her face with parted, smiling lips, quickly kissed his mouth and both eyes, and then pushed him away. She was about to go, but he held her back.
When?
He whispered, gazing rapturously at her.
Tonight at one,
she whispered, and with her quick, light step went to meet her son. Sir Edser had been caught in the rain in the public gardens, and he and his nurse had taken shelter in the pavilion. Well, au revoir, she said to Vronsky. It will soon be time to start for the races. Betsy has promised to call for me. Vronsky looked at his watch and hurried away. Chapter 24. When Vronsky looked at his watch on the Karenins' veranda, he was so agitated and so preoccupied that he saw the hands and face of the watch without realizing the time. He went to the high road, stepping carefully over the mud, and made his way to his calèche. He was so full of his feeling for Anna that he did not consider what o'clock it was or whether he still had time to call on Bryansky. He only retained, as often happens, the external capacity of memory which indicated what he had decided to do next. He approached his coachman, who was dozing on the box, in the already slanting shadow of a large lime tree, looked with pleasure at the swaying swarms of midges that whirled above the perspiring horses, and having roused the coachman, jumped into the calèche and told him to drive to Bryansky's. Only after going some 5 miles did he recollect himself sufficiently to look at his watch and to realize that it was already 5:30 and that he was late. There were to be several races that day. A lifeguards race, then an officer's 2-verst race, a 4-verst race, and then the one for which he had entered. He could be in time for his own race, but if he called on Bryansky first, he could only just manage it, and the whole court would already be at the racecourse. That was not the correct thing to do. But he had promised Bryansky to call, and therefore he decided to go on, telling the coachman not to spare the horses. He saw Bryansky, stayed with him 5 minutes, and drove back at a gallop. This quick drive soothed him. All that was depressing in his relations with Anna, the indefiniteness that remained after their conversation, escaped from his mind. He now thought with enjoyment and agitation of the race, and that after all he would be there in time, and occasionally the expectation of that night's meeting flashed brightly in his imagination. The spirit of the coming races overcame him more and more as he drove further and further into their atmosphere and overtook carriages making their way to the course from Petersburg and from outlying country places. When he reached his quarters, he found no one there. They had all gone to the races, and his valet was waiting at the gate. While he was changing his things, the valet told him that the second race had already begun, and that many gentlemen had been to inquire for him, and a lad had run over twice from the stables. Having changed without hurrying, he never hurried or lost his self-control, Vronsky ordered the coachman to drive him to the stables. From there he could see the sea of carriages, pedestrians and soldiers surrounding the racecourse, and the stands which were thronged with people. Probably the second race was just taking place, for as he entered the stables he heard the bell ring. On his way he met Mokhotin's white-legged chestnut gladiator, which, in a blue-bordered orange covering, with his ears looking enormous in their blue-trimmed cloth, was being led to the course. "Where is Cord?" he asked the groom. "In the stables, saddling." In her open box, Frou Frou stood ready saddled. They were just going to lead her out. "I'm not late." "All right, all right," answered the Englishman. "Don't upset yourself." Vronsky once again glanced at the beautiful, fascinating shape of the mare, whose whole body was trembling, and tearing himself with difficulty from this sight, he left the shed. He came towards the pavilions at the very best time to avoid attracting anyone's attention. The 2-verst race was nearly over, and all eyes were fixed on an officer of the horse guards in front and on a hussar officer behind, who were urging their horses to the last limits of their strength as they neared the winning post. From within and without the ring, everyone was crowding toward the winning post, and a group of horse guards, officers and men, with loud shouts, were expressing their joy at the expected triumph of their officer and comrade. Vronsky joined the crowd unnoticed,